Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rees Sheridan. On today's show,
the idea is to show Palm Springs literally in a different light. And I guess it's focusing on a dark side of the town that's kind of famous for its sunshine and hedonism.
We speak to a photographer who's captured Palm Springs' modernist homes by moonlight. Then,
this, in many ways, is about taking an island that is disengaged with the city and horizontally re-engaging it.
The University of Toronto's Faculty of Architecture, Landscape and Design has a new home. We take a tour. Plus, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson, joins Josh Fennett in the studio to give him her design picks. All that coming up right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. The mid-century modernist architecture of California's Palm Springs has been photographed thousands of times over the years. But now, in a new book called Midnight Modern, a young photographer called Tom Blatchford has taken a different approach to documenting the area's buildings, snapping them by moonlight. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Tom to find out more. He began by explaining the idea behind his unorthodox technique.
Midnight Modern, the idea is to show Palm Springs literally in a different light, shooting by the light of moon, and I guess it's focusing on a dark side of the town that's kind of famous for its sunshine and hedonism and the poolside life that usually goes on during the day, and there's kind of, it's only inferred in stories what happens by the night. So I guess I wanted to make the series to evoke those stories and kind of a mix of the stories that really happened and the stories that people can imagine for themselves.
What fascinated you about Palm Springs?
I mean, it's a pretty crazy landscape to have that concentration of houses with that backdrop of the mountains and to have such perfect period homes and all of these crazy cars dotted around, I guess, aesthetically drew me in from afar, which is why we wanted to go there in the first place. But I guess what's kept me going back is the kind of confusing feeling of not quite nostalgia, but just that you've kind of fallen down a time hole and you don't know when it is. You don't know if it's 1960 or you don't know if it's 2016. You know, it's that feeling of when I first went to Palm Springs on my first trip, I just remember not knowing when I was. And that's, I guess, what I've tried to translate with the images in the book, is that kind of happy confusion of not knowing whether something is now or then or whether it's both at once.
And, you know, as you mentioned, like, you don't know which era you are in a way, because the design is more or less the same, you know, from the modernist movement, like about 60 years ago, correct?
Yeah, well, a lot of the houses, they've been restored and they don't look exactly the same, but they're very similar. A lot of the people who love the homes and have bought them and restored them have done a really great job of it and have tried really hard to do it in a period correct way so that they don't, I guess, ruin that aesthetic that they had 60 years ago.
What was your relationship with the community, you know, of the residents? Because I guess you had to ask the authorization to take the pictures.
Well, I did and I didn't. The first two trips, I didn't know anybody and I didn't really know where to start and I didn't know what they would think of what I was doing. I mean, it's people photograph those houses all day. The streets are constantly full of people snapping those houses. But at night, it kind of feels illicit. It feels wrong, even though there's nothing wrong with it. So the first two trips I shot without any access or permission or any friends in the community, and it was on the third trip or between the second and the third trip that I reached out finally and got in contact to, I was really nervous to talk to someone and say, you know, have you seen these? What do you think of them? And that's when I kind of got in touch with the community and then all the doors kind of opened up and now it's outrageous. The generosity of the people in the town is crazy. People open their hearts and open their homes and welcome us in and throw parties for us and let us stay in their houses. It's crazy.
And tell us a bit more about, you know, the technique, you know, because, you know, again, as I said, the pictures are beautiful, but, you know, they were taken in the evening. What was the secret to make it such a beautiful picture in a way?
The secret is the moonlight and really unadulterated moonlight. Palm Springs, I guess it's a conscious decision. They have very few streetlights throughout most of the old suburbs, so there's not really any light pollution when it's dark. On a moonlit night, it's really the only light that's lighting up these houses is the light of the moon. So it allows me to, I guess, create that aesthetic by having the moon as the brightest light source. I can't even really explain it. It's kind of magic to me as well. Every time one pops up on the back of the camera, I can't really believe it either.
Well, they had, you know, it's written even in the book, 350 cloud-free days. I think that helps a bit.
It does. It definitely does. Although I was just there shooting a new series and I got five cloudy days or five cloudy nights, which was surprising.
Oh, dear. Do you have a house that you think it's really, you know, impressive and it does show Palm Springs in a very good way?
I think the image that's on the cover of the book, which is the Kaufman House, which was designed by Richard Neutra, and that was built in the 40s. And it doesn't look so impressive now. When I show it to people, they kind of can't understand why this house is so famous, why it was sold by Sotheby's as a work of art, why it sold for $18 million. But I think that's because it was so influential that really a lot of houses that have been built since still look like that. You know, it was the first of its kind in many ways. And I think that's amazing that it has the timelessness that the series has, but it is also timeless in the way that I guess the design values have just been continued for nearly 70 years now.
Did you notice that even the new constructions in Palm Springs, they still try to aim for this kind of modernist vibe as well, even if they are built, like, let's say, last year or this year as well?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of them spring up. I guess a lot of them try and copy, I guess, the silhouette of a lot of the houses, particularly the asymmetrical butterfly, which is kind of that beautiful V-shaped roof, which is gorgeous. But I'm not sure how I feel about those. I mean, I try not to concentrate on them for the series, but if all the good ones are sold out and people want a little piece of that, then I appreciate that.
The only place I've been to Palm Springs was the Parker Hotel, which is actually has a fantastic design. Have you ever been there?
I love the Parker. We're lucky enough nowadays that we get put up by lots of friends in Palm Springs, but if I had to stay in a hotel, it would absolutely be the Parker. I remember one day I found this red phone that was like an old president phone that you would call for a nuclear strike, hidden in the bushes in one of the swimming pools, and I just picked it up and it went straight to room service and I asked for a gin and tonic and a guy on a bike came and brought me a gin and tonic like 5 minutes later. It was amazing.
That's amazing. And, you know, Tom, I have to say, one of my favorites, you know, to be honest, it's difficult to pick one, but I love the Hotel Lautner as well from 1947. And I love, because, you know, I'm a big fan of wood as well. Do you know much about this one?
Well, the history of the building, I won't try and give any dates, but it was bought very, very dilapidated by a friend of ours, Tracy, who with her business partner restored it kind of back to its original glory, or perhaps even better. It was a three-room hotel that you could drive up to in the middle of nowhere in Desert Hot Springs that was unloved for many, many years. So it's now very much loved and very much sought after for people to stay in. And I actually proposed to my fiancé at the Lautner Hotel, so it's a very special place for us.
Photographer Tom Blatchford there telling Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco about his new book, Midnight Modern, available now from Powerhouse Books. Last year, three of the six buildings nominated for the Royal Institute of British Architecture Stirling Prize were education buildings. And for the organisation's inaugural international prize, the gong went to a university building in Peru by Grafton Architects. Those are just the latest examples of educational buildings proving fruitful ground for architects. Large in scale and civic in function, their appeal as commissions is perhaps obvious. But what changes when the building is designed to house an architectural school? How to create a building that provides an example for the students studying within it, whilst not imposing on their imaginations with an overbearing aesthetic? The University of Toronto's Faculty of Architecture, Landscape and Design will soon have a new home at 1 Spadina, the historic location of one of the university's first buildings. To find out more, Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis took a tour of the building with architect Nadia Tirani, principal of NADA, the firm behind the project, and the dean of the faculty, Richard Sommer.
My name is Nader Tirani. I'm a principal of NADA, a firm in architecture and urbanism. And I'm working on the Daniels Building with Richard Sommer, who is serving as dean.
Fantastic. The introduction's done for you.
Exactly. I'm Richard Sommer, dean of the Daniels Faculty of Architecture, Landscape and Design at the University of Toronto.
Fantastic. And here we are at the original building, I suppose, on
it's
the site.
It's one of the first two buildings on the campus, University College, which will people will say is the first building for University of Toronto, but it burned down. So this is actually the oldest freestanding structure in this area. And what's interesting is, you know, the people who were really building up Toronto in the 18th and 19th century, it was a very, you know, colonial city of land deals, like a gridiron city. So we're standing on this circle in one of the few what I call kind of flourishes or exceptions to the grid, which is this large circle which was built by wealthy landowners that lived at the top of the hill. They wanted to come down here and have a view down to the lake and you know, have a really a kind of prospect to the lake. That's the origins of the site. Then later it was taken over by the Knox Theological Seminary, or it was built on by the Knox Theological Seminary to train seminarians.
As I understand it, your initial sort of commission was to redevelop the existing building when then this sort of became the new plan. What did you sort of set out to do when this was sort of decided on as the site to house the new faculty?
So this site happened later. The actual initial competition was for 230 College Street. And when we got the commission finally to do this site, we actually started with a much more holistic analysis of what it means to connect this back to the city. We weren't even delving that deeply into the programs of the School of Architecture per se. We were looking at it as a piece of urbanism. Even at that point, there was the prospect of possibly engaging a residential tower as part of the scheme, something that may
the
have...
The new Toronto, so to speak.
The new Toronto.
But we decided against that.
Exactly. So let's just say the beginning phases were incredibly speculative in all senses of the word.
He's being very humble. He did about 10 different schemes. I did about 10 different schemes, at least. We have a record of them. And not only that, Nadir ran a studio with our students at the school and then at MIT. So we looked at it with the students. He looked at it in various different ways. And it's really interesting that we moved away from doing this renovation of the previous building, because I was recently in London visiting a great school of architecture, the Bartlett, that's part of UCL. And they essentially did the scheme we were going to do, which is they took a kind of tall existing urban building, 4 or 5 stories, and they rewrapped it.
And they added on top too?
A little bit. Very similar scheme. It works, but it's nothing like this because it doesn't have the possibility of, in a sense, unfolding into the city.
So in many ways, this project, although not that self-consciously initially, is a response to the other project we did. That one had the challenge of creating community in a vertical building. So how you create a kind of social promenade that spirals up. This, in many ways, is about taking an island that is disengaged with the city and horizontally re-engaging it.
You know, Nader and I were both educated at the same time, and there was this amazing English architectural critic, or I guess he was a theorist, Robin Evans, and he wrote an article that we all read called Figures, Doors, and Pastures, which was a kind of critique, if you will, of buildings that had too many corridors, and a theory that somehow they produced too much privacy, right? And this is related to a tradition in modern architecture which eliminated, let's say, corridors because they're wasteful, right? So you would have much more efficient spaces. But this building, and we're standing in it right now, the old part of the building, old One Spadina, has these enormous corridors. They're 10 or 12 feet wide. And in fact, we would have never been able to build a building with corridors like this. And as you can see here, we've actually lined them with these pin-up walls because we see the corridors as a kind of social space and a space of creative exchange. And the same is true, the corridor is linked to them, the street and the new building. So there's a notion that not only the spaces that are dedicated to things like the studios and the fabrication labs, but the spaces of exchange like corridors and these other things are as important for the culture of the school. And that's actually what our old building and many buildings, many efficiently planned university buildings are missing, which is this kind of unprogrammed or openly programmed kind of space. So we realized that our great teacher might have been actually wrong. Right?
It should also be...
as brilliant as he was.
Yeah. No, but it should be mentioned also that this idea of the programmable interstitial spaces like these corridors are linked to the pedagogies of architecture in a kind of salient way. There's probably no classroom in any other discipline area that works like a crit or a review or a pinup, as we have it here. It's the one moment where a teacher does not really stand up on a lectern and give a lecture down to the students. It's the one moment where a student authors a body of work, and that becomes the sort of hinge point for an entire conversation. Obviously, the faculty members, the critics, and the students bring to that discussion a body of historical thinking, theoretical thinking, as well as formal and architectural precedents. And the conversation that happens, that ensues as a result of that, is what we call design thinking, what many others have now appropriated,
co-opted. But we've been doing it since, you know, at least the 18th century.
So while the building actually has some classrooms,
The
majority of the building is characterized by open-ended spaces where pinups may happen and where these kinds of events will happen. So when you're en route between your office and the studio, or from the lecture to the bathroom, the chances are you're engaged in the culture of the other studios of which you would not normally be a part. Had they been in classrooms, you wouldn't see them.
In fact, Nutter used to teach at MIT, and one of the big problems of their architecture program is that all of the spaces are actually sequestered in separate spaces, and you don't have that possibility that you have here. Every time I come into school each day, I'm going to see people's work being reviewed, and even if I'm not involved, or I can observe for a half an hour and really get a sense for what's taking the temperature of what's happening at the school at any given moment.
I wanted to ask you, this is your first commission in Canada. What kind of city is Toronto to build in? I mean, it is a city that's changing very quickly, both, you know, I suppose, in terms of its built environment and other ways too. What kind of city were you sort of reacting to? And I suppose for you as well. You
know, I was new to the city when we started this, yeah.
And having sort of architecture students, you know, beneath your wings. Mm-hmm. You know, is this a particularly exciting sort of malleable place to build an architecture school?
When I came, I was attracted to both the University of Toronto because it's a, you know, incredible research university embedded in the middle of a kind of growing and transforming city with an incredible kind of transnational population. But I didn't know the city that well. I knew because we got a great gift from a donor that we would have to build a building, but I didn't know what sort of building. I quickly met a number of people in the city, and they kind of took me aside and they said, you know what? It's not good enough to do a renovation of a building on a kind of old, somewhat ratty building on the edge of the campus. Toronto is a city that's coming into its own, and one specifically said to me, you have to build a school of architecture and landscape and design that when someone comes to Toronto and they're interested in architecture design, they can't not come to your building. That was an incredible challenge. So it's an incredible time for the city of Toronto, but we were very, very fortunate that the university and a lot of people didn't realize the value or the kind of potential of the site we're standing in because it was formidable in terms of its entry costs and in terms of taking on the old building. And as you said, when we were downstairs, you don't really realize when you drive around it how big it is. So it was because I became involved very quickly in the campus planning deliberations, I saw the footprint and I said, well, where else could you get a site like this in a city like this? I mean, we have our entire graduate studio on one floor, right? As I was mentioning, UCL building, and they're divided on five floors. We're currently on three different floors. So the potential that the site gave, that's why we decided actually not to build high, because the whole city's becoming high, and you know these condominiums are coming up like mushrooms, but sometimes doing something lower and more active on the ground is a way to make something more distinctive. And this is the only site in this entire sector of the city where you could have ever done that.
Nader Tarani and Richard Sommer there, giving Monocle's Thomas Lewis a tour of the new home of the University of Toronto's Faculty of Architecture, Landscape and Design. Still to come on the show, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson tells us what design delights have caught her eye in Japan.
Monocle's style special sets a striking tone for the spring-summer season, including a countdown of the shops, stylists and tailors worth keeping an eye on, Outlandish Outfits Mark Hour Expo, where our culture editor, Robert Bound, meets a colourful cast of characters at Southeast Asia's hottest festival, Wonder Fruit. A different kind of look is examined in affairs as we dive headlong into the field with Sweden's soldiers. And in entertaining, it's off to Germany to meet the culinary world's freshest new talent, the Thermomix. Issue 102 of Monocle, on newsstands now.
We recently had the pleasure of hosting Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson at our HQ in London. She joined the show's usual presenter, Josh Fennett, here in the studio to talk about what's going on the Japanese design team at the moment. It included Kengo Kuma's redevelopment architecture and the loyalty of Japanese fashion customers. But they began by talking about the work of a little-known manufacturer of catering utensils that Fiona's written about for the magazine.
Fiona, welcome to the office. We can't reveal the circumstances at Play and Midori House too much, but it's a rather busy week. It's production week. How are you feeling? What's it like to be in town?
Yeah, it's a bit of a shock. I mean, I'm so used to being in a satellite office where it's a bit more peaceful. Here it's all guns blazing. But no, it's good to see everyone. It's good to catch up.
And one of the nice things about the catch up for the people at HQ here at Midori House is to hear some of the stories that our far-flung correspondents and bureaus have been covering recently. So we're going to do a little bit of a design roundup from the Tokyo perspective. And we're going to start out by talking about a rather remarkable industrial design story. Says a little bit more about Tokyo and Japanese design than the simple cocktail shakers and whatnot it produces.
It's interesting because Yukiwa is not a name anyone would ever have heard of. I mean, you would, if you were in the restaurant trade in Japan, you'd know. You'd be thinking, if I want to get a dessert trolley, that's where I'm going.
A dessert trolley?
You know, side of roast beef, straight to Yukiwa, the roll top dish, you know, all these things for a buffet. Gravy boats, the works, they make them. They don't make them in Tokyo, they make them in Niigata. It's famous for stainless steel. I went there. It's very snowy in the winter, actually, there, well into the winter. And, you know, we went to see how it's all made. I was in heaven. I love that brand.
And one of the things that really captured my imagination, you and I spoke over the phone in the kind of commissioning of this story, and was this idea that there's a kind of a social or a kind of culinary history of Tokyo wound up in the making of these products. That and the fact that they make some pretty astoundingly named products, a European sherbet wagon, for instance, and their share of sneeze guards. But what's the story behind this company that tells us something about the way that Japanese culture has changed?
Yeah, I mean, what's really interesting about the company is why they sort of cleaned up in the restaurant business is they've kept the moulds for the products they've been making for years. So they've now built it up to 5,000 different products, you know, most of whom nobody would actually want. But I think, you know, what's interesting is because they've kept them over the years, Japan has had fads for different kind of Western food over the years. So suddenly curry turned up in Japan, and Yukiwa were the people who turned the gravy boat into the curry boat effectively. And still today, curry rice, it's served in these European gravy boats and Yukiwa makes them. Then, you know, suddenly buffet restaurants became very popular in Japan. They make all the equipment for that. You know, you can imagine all the tongs, all the heated dishes, all that. So they do that. And when I looked at it, I thought it's really interesting. There's something vaguely retro. No, it's not just vaguely. I mean, you know, a European sherbet wagon. Actually, I don't know when they were ever in vogue, but they have like the bubble year products. Absolutely brilliant. They had a 3-meter boat in stainless steel that you can have a, you know, you can serve your dinner from.
Just in case. And it's a wonderful story. And you and I did had a bit of a chuckle looking through the catalogue, not in a kind of mean way, but just seeing, you know, the actual industrial design, the work that goes into the kind of catering side of cooking is just so far away from the traditional ceramics and the things that we often think about when we put together the magazine. So I love that story. We're going to move on to another bit of a magazine mainstay, the idea of fashion. This story, I think, came from some kind of overheard whispers about the persistent strength of the Japanese fashion market. And you did rather a lot of research on this. So can you tell us why Japan may or may not save fashion?
I know the headline's quite extravagant, you know, and people have said, can Japan really save fashion? I mean, what this story was really about is that if you've been in Asia over the last decade, there was so much talk in the luxury industry about China and Russia, the new markets. Everyone rushed to open there, particularly China, hundreds of shops, and hasn't quite worked out the way people hoped it would. A lot of these shops are very empty. People with money in mainland China are maybe now shopping somewhere else. They're travelling to Tokyo often to shop. So this story really came about as a lot of brands at Fashion Week earlier this year were saying, we kind of turned our attention back to Japan. It never went away. They're very loyal customers. They really appreciate quality. They understand what we do. And I think there was a feeling of appreciation of this sort of level of knowledge of the sort of Japanese customer. And they haven't turned away from luxury. And I think there's a feeling it's not a fad in Japan. People are dedicated, long-term customers. And it's a sort of, it was a bit of a mutual love-in, I think, at Fashion Week this year.
Well, that's nice. I like the idea that we, as a brand, overhear these rumours in Milan and we toss them across to the Tokyo office to look into in detail. You know, as someone that's lived in the city and the country for over a decade, does this ring true with you? Do you think the Japanese market is a more loyal market?
I mean, I think you just walk around the streets of Tokyo, people are incredibly well-dressed in a, you know, very general way. But what I've really noticed is Japan supports a lot of niche European brands, you know, people who are making leather accessories. Brands like John Lobb, these shoes are extremely expensive. They've done very, very well in Japan. People will pay the money for quality. They're not really interested in flashy labels or showing how they've spent their money, but they do want something that's worth buying. And you know, not just older men. That is a huge market now. People are after these, you know, the silver money, they want that. But I think also younger people, they don't buy lots of things, but they may buy one really good pair of shoes. And we were talking about this in the office, you know, Paraboot, that's a brand. These shoes are, you know, $800, $900. And you see kind of young people wearing them. I'm not sure that would necessarily be happening in London. I think they'd all be in trainers. So yeah, it's a slightly different rhythm, I think, in Japan.
And finally, on this kind of whistle-stop tour of industrial design, of fashion, it's only fair that we give architecture a tiny bit of a look in. Now, in early March, there was a rebuilding project by Kengo Kuma, which is newsworthy in itself because of the architect's fine work and envelope-pushing designs. But this is also a story about a kind of rebuilding. Tell me what caught your eye about it.
Well, I mean, you know, Japan had this tsunami in 2011. The northeast of Japan was really devastated. These towns, you know, it was already a pretty poor part of Japan. And then the tsunami absolutely flattened. 20,000 people died in the tsunami. And the rebuilding process has been really slow, actually. And what's interesting is a lot of architects have been wanting to build things there. And it's only now that we're starting to see the fruits of their labour. Kengo Kuma, who is possibly the busiest man in architecture, I mean, he is pretty much everywhere at the moment. And if he's not writing, he's speaking, he's being filmed. And he's just done, it's a little sort of shopping development. It's very well done, very small scale, a group of 20-odd shops in 6 wooden buildings. You know, it's just the right scale. It's a very sympathetic project. I mean, I think this whole redevelopment of that area, it encouraged architects to think a bit more the human scale of things. What really will help, it's not just about putting a shiny new building, it's about community rebuilding in these cases. So, I mean, it has a real value for a community. So, and it's not about just making money. So it's a very different way of building. And it's not the same way they're building in Tokyo, which is really about, we need footfall. We want to get people into these shops. It's how can we help these really devastated communities?
Our Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson there. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell, and the man behind the glass, Kieran Banerjee. If you've got any comments or queries, then feel free to email me at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. And until next time, it's goodbye from me.